everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2024, and you're listening to episode 404, which is a conversation about what's going on with the pro-life movement and the latest around abortion-related issues. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merrily Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and all pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "A String of Losses for the Pro-Life Movement and Our Message of Hope." And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Jay, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
It's always great to be here.
Well, today, Jay and I are going to dive deep into the issue of where the pro-life movement is right now. And the issue of abortion is always of note, but particularly in election years, and most particularly in presidential election years, it's an issue that is really focused on for both of the two major parties, both the Republicans and the Democrats. And as I said in a previous episode that we just had last week, you know, the Christian Research Journal is nonpartisan and not political. So people will wonder, well, why do we and have we in 45 years continued to cover the subject of abortion, which seems so political to people? And I just want to remind our listeners once again that the Christian Research Journal has always addressed a wide variety of issues within the intersection of Christian ethics as it is informed by Christian orthodoxy. And this certainly falls under that category. And those issues include the sanctity of life, which is not just limited to abortion, but reproductive technologies, euthanasia. We cover marriage, sexuality, LGBTQ matters, war, religious freedom, and a lot of other biblically relevant topics of our time. And so this is not a politically driven discussion, but rather something that is talking about Christian ethics, and abortion has always been well within the journal's purview, and we've been covering it for, as I mentioned, more than 45 years. So today I want to have Jay on and talk about some of the various different issues that have come up in the last several months in this year, maybe in 2024, regarding the pro-life movement. And things are moving so fast that maybe some of the things we're talking about today are going to be out of date by the time we release this podcast in the next week or two. And so I just wanted to say that up front. But the biggest news that has happened in the news cycle, which frankly is shorter than 24 hours, but in the last 24 hours, President Joe Biden has decided not to be the Democratic nominee and run for another term in the fall, which kind of throws everything into a lot of just moving parts for the Democratic Party this year at such a late stage. Now, the reason why this is of importance is he has endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, as the person that he would like to see be the presumptive nominee. And the reason why we want to cover Kamala Harris is she has been doing some unusual things this year with regard to her focus on abortion, because it's very interesting. Earlier this year, and I want to ask Jay about this, she was the first sitting vice president to actually go to an abortion clinic and talk to staff there. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, she visited a clinic in Minnesota, or an abortion facility in Minnesota. Kamala Harris is different than Joe Biden, and that Joe Biden has always seemed tortured to some degree and publicly tortures himself over the abortion issue. And meaning what he says is, I'm personally and privately Catholic, and so my Catholic views inform me how I should act personally, but I publicly pursue policy different from those belief systems. And so there's been a tension with him all along. That tension does not exist with her. She has been a full-throated supporter for abortion rights entirely throughout her political career. And so it was not for her to go there and to do this photo op there was a part of really the change that we've seen over the last few years, as far as the stomach that the public has for the abortion issue changes a bit. You know, it does all the time. The general public swings back and forth on this. And so her going there was a declaration of her support and by extension, the Biden administration's support for the issue of abortion. Now that she may be, I mean, obviously she would like to be the candidate. She said she wants to earn to be the candidate. President Biden has endorsed her as the candidate. She has some hills to overcome on that. She hasn't been a particularly popular vice president, and her vice presidency has sort of been defined by her inability to speak clearly at times or the awkwardness of her public persona. But if she does become the nominee, we're talking about a nominee who is more passionate, politically more committed to the issue of abortion advocacy by far more than what President Biden has been. So her presence there was really a declaration for the whole administration of their commitment to that issue. But for her to be there was different than for Biden to be there because, number one, it keeps him from having to wrestle with it publicly like he always seems to do. But she gets to be that champion of that as a part of his administration. Well, now the champion as the vice president may be the actual nominee and possible future president of the United States. So it does change the optics as far as how we look at this ticket.
Well, it's interesting, as this visit was covered by the New York Times earlier this year, they noted that she just didn't go there, but she visited five different states really on kind of a nationwide tour to talk about abortion rights. So does this put this issue a little bit more front and center than usually a presidential election year to appeal to the broadest, you know, audience within the electorate as possible? They don't usually try to do that. They try to win over people who might be, have just a little bit, you know, wavering on the issue of abortion, maybe not as staunchly pro-abortion as Kamala Harris is.
Well, the 2022 election cycle was supposed to be a big cycle for the Republicans, and it was not. And there are two schools of thought on why it was not. The first school of thought was it was Donald Trump's fault, that Donald Trump supported a bunch of candidates and Donald Trump was more unpopular than he seems to be now. And so there was a lot of people trying to blame Donald Trump for it. The other excuse was, or the large thing that was given, was that abortion was on the ballot in states all over the country, and that the people who were turning out to support abortion rights, either to stop state initiatives that were meant to restrict abortion or to encourage or to enforce state amendments or state initiatives that were meant to keep or protect abortion rights in that state, that the turnout for abortion was so strong that it turned out for the Democrats that abortion was the winning issue in 2022. And that was the key takeaway. So that her state by state on behalf of the Biden administration tour that she did, including visiting that facility in Minnesota, was a part of strengthening that view that the Democratic Party is the party of abortion rights. Abortion rights are a winning thing right now on the ticket for the Democratic Party. And so they're trying to align themselves more fully with that. We've seen, by the way, repercussions for that all the way through the political system in both the Democratic and Republican Party. The sense right now is that abortion is a winning issue for the Democratic side. They have seen multiple victories throughout multiple states coming off of the heels of the Dobbs decision that overruled Roe v. Wade. And so Kamala Harris had tried to align the Biden administration strongly with that issue going into this election cycle, which is different than any election cycle we've been in 40 years. We just haven't seen this because Roe v. Wade is gone. And now we have a presidential election cycle that's not talking about Roe v. Wade. It's not talking about a national issue. It's talking about a state-by-state issue. And on the state-by-state level, abortion is a winning issue for the Democratic Party right now. And she's aligning herself strongly with that. And we'll, that will be a theme of her election, I'm sure, if she becomes the presumptive candidate.
Well, I want to talk about some big picture issues before we talk about the pro-life cause in particular, like what's happened since the fall of Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. And you alluded to that. And one thing I will tell our listeners is one of the things that you see over and over again is And maybe you're a listener who's wondering about that. You know, how can you say abortion is morally wrong when it involves the decision of a doctor and a patient, as well as, in particular, the bodily autonomy of the individual who's pregnant? And I just want to say that we have covered this many times and answered that question so many times in the Christian Research Journal. And so we will give you links to all of those in-depth deep dives answering those questions in our show notes. But I want to ask Jay right now, besides what you alluded to just a moment ago, what are some of the other big picture differences before we kind of drill down into this issue when we talk about what has happened since the fall of Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think, and I alluded to some of it a second ago, for the pro-life movement since 1973, when you, especially as it sort of it became more crystallized on presidential elections, it was very easy because there was one big thing that everyone was going for. We have to beat Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade took the ability for states to make decisions away from them and said that there is a constitutional right for women to be able to get an abortion. And so we had to be able to beat that. So that was a national thing. Every pro-life organization in the country had one thing, one goal in common, which was to ultimately bring down Roe v. Wade. But 2 years ago, that happened. And so it went from a singular issue that we could all focus on, and that all of our, as far as efforts that we were working towards, were aiming at being able to get past that thing, that hurdle, to suddenly a 50-state issue. Because what Dobbs versus Jackson did was it said Roe v. Wade is wrongly decided. There is no constitutional right to abortion. And so every state now has the ability to decide for themselves what the abortion laws within their community ought to be. And once it became a 50-state issue, it became possible for everyone to vote on it. So the question then was, how would people vote? Now, here what I say is the big change that we've seen. For years building up towards Roe v. Wade, you saw this sort of public sentiment land towards the idea of they didn't like, they were uncomfortable with abortion, and the pro-choice side would lose arguments as long as we're talking about questions like, what is the unborn? What is this life that we're allowed to destroy it? Let's look at that life and see what the practice of abortion is doing to it. When it went to 50 states, there was the pendulum swung the other way, and suddenly the public seemed to be very animated about the idea of women being repressed. Their rights had been stolen from them. We're worried about what women can and can't do. The government shouldn't be involved in their lives. Touching again what you talked about just a second ago, this bodily autonomy argument, the idea that women should be able to control their bodies. The issue where they lost all the time is when it was on the unborn. And when it was a national issue about what we were doing to the unborn, it was easier to have that argument. Then it became a state-by-state issue about what women are allowed to do, and we saw unexpected losses. Now, there were major gains immediately. You saw large population states like Texas and Florida and even Georgia here, South Carolina, places all over the country that suddenly had abortion-restrictive laws in the books, and they were constitutional, and they could protect the unborn within the borders of their state. But there was an expectation of there being more. And that more never happened. It didn't materialize. As a matter of fact, you started seeing defeats in places like Kentucky, in places like Michigan, in places like Ohio, places where you expected to win, you were losing. And you were losing, it seemed like in Arizona, and you were losing in New Mexico. You're losing in places where it was up for grabs. And so what happens now is that as the public sentiment has shifted towards the women on this issue and feels like that went too far with the fall of Roe, and there was this sort of fear that grew in the general public about maybe we swung too far, they swung the other way for a moment, and it's left the pro-life movement trying to figure out how to manage this 50-state fight. And it's left a more energized Democratic Party feeling excited about what they can get done at the election through the election cycle with the issue of abortion, and being able to hammer the Republicans with, you took away Roe, you took away women's rights, now we're going to be able to use this issue to push forward. So it fractured what was a clear vision of for this one unified movement into 50 different movements. And at the same time, it shifted the public sentiment towards the other side. And the Democratic Party has made gains with that on a national level for the last 2 years, and they feel very confident if they can do that going into this election cycle, they'll be able to maintain control of the House and the Senate and the executive branch.
2024 is a presidential election year, and so therefore certain ethical issues in the public square are mentioned a lot in media sources, as well as seeing a lot of activity about the issue of abortion online. As I mentioned in my opening comments, the issue of abortion is not a political issue at all. It has to do with Christian ethics that comes out of Christian orthodoxy, and Christians that think Christianly need to think about what these issues mean and what that means for them as a Christian to hold to a Christian worldview. So, I don't know if you've noticed this, but in every episode of this podcast, in the show notes, we have all kinds of additional links and resources for you. And today, we will definitely have linked in the show notes wherever you find them, whether it's on YouTube or your favorite podcasting source, or on our website, you will see those links for additional food for thought, many of them articles from Jay Watts, but also articles that have addressed frequently used argumentation from people who are pro-abortionists and hold to that view. And that has been answered many decades ago and continues to be answered, but maybe you're new here and you've missed those links. So please always check out the links in the show notes. In addition, we would be so grateful for your partnership. And part of that is just getting the word out about all of our podcast episodes so that people can discover this, that maybe didn't know that our podcast has been around for 8 years and more than 400 episodes. You can do that by sharing your favorite episodes on your social media accounts or emailing them to a friend or simply telling a friend. Literal word of mouth would really help us out. And of course, we would be grateful if you would help us out with a tip. And you can do that at our website, equip.org. Click on Journal, click on Postmodern Realities Podcast, and you will find at any of the landing pages that there's a link to be able to give us a tip. Also, as I've mentioned since the beginning of this year, we have a brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. It's called Christian Research Journal Reads. And what it is our journal articles in audio format. So we have quite a few. We have more than 30 already out. You will want to subscribe to that at your favorite podcast platform or look at our website, equip.org. How you find all the back episodes would be, again, click on Journal. You will see a tab there, headline for Christian Research Journal Reads. If you click on that, you will see all of our episodes. So now back to my conversation about the pro-life movement with Jay Watts. So you mentioned just the different framing that has changed in the language before when Roe was, you know, intact versus yes. Now that it's been overturned. So how is it that they made such an impact in such a short time? Because some of the bodily autonomy argumentation has been out since the 1970s. So it's not like it's new arguments that haven't been addressed. And so why did people, it just didn't really connect with him for literally almost 40 years. And suddenly there's this big shift in terms of how the debate is even framed.
Years ago, I heard a man talking about what it takes to start a movement in the United States. And he said, you think that it takes a lot, but realistically, you have a large body of people that are very convinced of their position on both sides of any position. And so what you need is a small percentage. He said something like 5% can begin it, right? If you can win over 5% of the people to your side who are on the undecided area, you can start a major shift as far as the way that the public is going. And I think that that's the way we have to look at it, right? You have your dyed-in-the-wool pro-life, you have your dyed-in-the-wool pro-choice, you have your abortion advocates, you have your anti-abortion advocates, you have the people fighting that are never going to switch their positions on either side of that. And then in the middle of that, you have a group of people who change their opinion on this or undecided about it or feel uncomfortable with the extremes on both sides and are trying to find some place where they can settle that all sides or all parts of what they're worried about are being addressed. Once Dobbs fell, everyone went towards the woman. And so when you talk about, because you said the bodily autonomy arguments have actually been around longer than Roe v. Wade had been around. I mean, they predated Roe v. Wade. And so what happened was that when that that message of the women are the victim of restrictive abortion laws became very strongly felt with a group of people. And so instead of the unborn human life being the victim of abortion, women became the victims of bad abortion laws. And with that shift, with the way they talked about it, they were able to, and you see this, they've been very good. And the way I know they've been very good at it is because when you go to college campuses, I have many friends who go to college campuses. I go to college campuses. We address or talk to college students. And when you hear the questions that college students are asking you, they're usually indicative of what message is getting to them. And one of the things that I have noticed, both with my friends and the videos that they share and with the conversations that I'm having with people, is that one particular message has landed very well. When you start talking about the wrong of the moral wrong of killing an innocent human life early in its development, what I hear back often is this question or this statement. No. Women are human beings. What's destroyed during abortion is merely an embryo or merely a fetus. It's just a fetus. It's not a human. It's just an embryo. It's not a human. I hear that all the time, both in my interactions with people and the interactions that my friends are sharing online. And that message is starting from New York Times articles where they talk about the idea where they question. And I mentioned that one of those in the article where they're questioning in the Idaho law, they talked about unborn. In Dobbs versus Jackson, Samuel Alito used the term unborn children or preborn children. This terminology comes up a lot, and you see multiple different authors talking about this idea that that's not a child, that's not an unborn, it's not a preborn, it's a fetus. It's a fetus or an embryo, and that is medically accurate or scientifically accurate, and it's manipulative to call them a fetus. That you're manipulating people's emotion, or to call them the unborn children is manipulating them. If you call them unborn, it's manipulating to call them preborn. You're trying to generate some sort of sympathy or empathy for this life, but it's not a life like you and me. It's completely different than you and me. What it is, it's a fetus or an embryo only, and that's a medically accurate term. So stop calling it an unborn child, call it an embryo, call it a fetus, be accurate. That message comes from multiple different sources, and it must be landing very hard with our young people, because it's one of the objections that I hear the most now when I talk to them, is they demand that I explain why I want to treat a fetus the same way I would treat the woman who is pregnant with the fetus. And then we have to have a conversation about that a fetus is not a thing. An embryo is not a thing. Embryonic stages and fetal stages are stages of development that things pass through. So when you call it an embryo or fetus, you're not actually being accurate. It's not medically accurate to say, or scientifically accurate to say, it is an embryo or it's a fetus. It's scientifically or medically accurate to say it's embryonic human. It's a fetal human. Those are stages of development that human life passes through. So we can't just dismiss their value by claiming that they're merely embryos or merely fetuses. That's no more scientifically accurate or medically accurate than any other terms that we use, because it's an incomplete statement or incomplete description. A complete description is it's an embryonic human. It's a fetal human. Embryonic stage and fetal stages, just like infancy, just like adulthood, just like childhood, just like adolescence. These are all stages of development that we move through. The fetal stage and the embryonic stage are stages that human beings advance through. And when we're talking about abortion, we're not talking about embryonic dogs or embryonic dolphins or embryonic elephants. We're talking about embryonic human lives. But that message has landed hard with young people, and they've done a great job at this point, as the sense that women's rights have been taken from them has landed very hard with them. They've also messaged it with this idea that the rights have been sacrificed for the sake of fetuses and embryos. They're not even human like you and I are. And we have to push back very hard and say, no. They're embryonic humans, fetal humans. They are humans like you and I are. They look just like we do, in the sense that when we went through that stage, that you and I went through that stage, we looked exactly like that. And every single one of us in our development as human beings were once a fetus, were once an embryo. We went through that just like every other human did.
So I hear you saying that just the objection right now to the pro-life movement, and even in some of the legal writings, has been using the terms, as you noted, unborn, preborn, unborn or preborn child, and those things are misleading, and it's more medically accurate to say fetus and embryo. But I'm just wondering, you know, when you're saying, well, these are humans that are in this stage, this fetal stage, is it accurate to use the term child? Because I think a lot of young people also are very much influenced by Darwinian evolution in that to say that human beings are similar to animals and animals have rights and humans have rights and women have rights over their bodies. How do you answer that? What would be the difference if we called it a child more, or are fetal embryonic humans children? And even if we say they are children, how are they different than any other animal if some people posit that human beings are a kind of animal?
Yeah, okay, good. Let's do two parts. Number one, are they children? One of the sense is when we say children, we oftentimes mean like a baby or like an infant or a toddler. They're thinking in terms of when I say child, what I mean is these stages of development, as if I'm confused and I don't understand that there's a difference between an embryo and a toddler. I understand fully well. There are huge differences between an embryo and a toddler. An embryonic human and a toddler human have massively different levels of development. And that's why they're categorized differently from each other. It's because of what they're capable of doing or the capacities that they have in those particular stages, how they look, all of those things. But here's the thing. Child, by definition, and there's a Supreme Court case, Alabama Supreme Court case, that was talking about this in light of embryos that were destroyed and that were kept out of the kept in storage, that were destroyed, and there was a wrongful death lawsuit over this. And in the wrongful death lawsuit, where they said, look, our children were destroyed, sure, they were embryos and they were not inside my wife's body or were inside the mother's body, but they were still our children and they were destroyed and we should be compensated for this because of wrongful death. And in arguing this, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court laid out a historical legal case where he said it has always been the case that we understood that children were children from the moment they come into existence, because there's definitions of children like the direct biological progeny of their parents. So in that sense, yeah, every embryo or fetus is the child of some mother and father. And it is technically correct and legally correct, as what was argued by the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. And it has been throughout his, he provides not just modern evidence as far as definition, but he goes all the way back to Blackstone and goes back to these different things where he says, look, this has always been the case where we talk about the idea of the immediate biological progeny of parents are their children. Now, I don't use the word children a lot in what I talk about, because I say offspring a lot, but that's not because I don't think there are children and the definition doesn't fit. It's because I know that that may be a problem with the audience, and I don't want them to get hung up on the verbiage. I want them to get hung up on the arguments. I want us to stay on the main thing and not have to quibble or argue about the term child. But the term baby, I think, falls into that area where it's okay, that's manipulative. Right now, I'm not saying that people who say baby are doing it in bad faith. They genuinely believe that's my baby, or they talk about their unborn baby, or they're carrying their child. A lot of women, when they're carrying their children, talk about them being their baby. But I do understand that objection when they say, well, it's not a baby. It's a fetus or an embryo. You're right. It is an embryonic human. It is a fetal human. And I agree with you that we can make divisions about not calling it a baby. But calling it a child is technically accurate. It is the immediate biological progeny of the parents. It's an immature child, but it's still a child. And so there's nothing inaccurate or nothing manipulative about recognizing that fact. Now, I'll call it offspring if that makes you feel better. And it seems to do. It does seem to work that when I say offspring, I have fewer fights or arguments about it. But at the end of the day, like when I personally try to consider how I feel about these things, I will say, okay, I understand your objection to the term baby, because that one is a different emotional tie to it. But the term child just has a meaning or a definition. And one of those definitions is the immediate biological progeny of the parents. And so your embryonic children are just that. Embryonic human children, fetal human children, they are children. So an unborn child is in no way an illegitimate way to reference a life. Not unscientific, and it's not unmedical, not medical. It doesn't fall. Their criticism on that fails, and their solution to it is incomplete because they don't finish the fetal or embryo description.
One thing I've noticed recently is a discussion in articles online that what people hear in the early stages when you go in for an ultrasound when you're very first pregnant, even before 12 weeks, what you're hearing there is not really the heartbeat of the embryo. And some of this is actually claimed by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And they are saying that there is no heartbeat in embryonic human life in early stages. So these things that have been named heartbeat laws are inaccurate. Is that true? Because what when you hear that on the ultrasound, it is not actually a heartbeat. It's what has been going around recently, that that is inaccurate to say that, you know, at 8 or 9 weeks, what you're hearing is a heartbeat. It's that's not exactly what it is.
Yeah, here's their argument as far as their explanation for their point of view. And you have seen this objection throughout the media when you're talking about media that are friendly to abortion advocacy. They refuse to recognize heartbeat laws, and they usually reference them by whatever week, like they'll call them 6 week bans. They call them 6 week bans because it's at about the 6 week, it's your earliest chance of being able to detect this embryonic cardiac activity. So what they're saying is this is why they make the claim that it's not a heartbeat. They say, when I, as a doctor, not me, but when these members of the ACOG, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, say when we as doctors listen to the heartbeat of a mature human being, what we're hearing are the valves opening and closing, that thump, 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 thump. You know, we're hearing the chambers of the heart and the air and the valves into those chambers opening and closing. And so they say that is what a heartbeat is. And when we talk about the cardiac tube that we're listening to at that point, even though it is a cardiac tube that is spasming in the sense that it is pumping and it is moving fluid through it, they say that cardiac tube is not a heart. And so they say this is their response then. It's more accurate to call it an embryonic cardiac activity, right? But, you know, cardiac just means by definition having to do with the heart. So their solution is don't you dare call it a heartbeat. What you need to call it is embryonic activity or fetal activity having to do with the heart, which I don't think is as huge a distinction as they would like it to be. And it's trying to prejudice itself against that idea. But so it is actually the heart in the sense that it is the various earliest manifestations of the heart beginning to work. It is not identical to the heartbeat that you would hear if you were listening to an adult human heartbeat, because they are correct when they say it isn't the valves, and they're correct when they say there are no chambers of the heart. But is it the muscle of the heart beginning its very earliest contractions to move fluid through that will ultimately mature into the same kind of heartbeat that they're hearing? Yes. So it is a cardiac activity. It is a heart activity that is being heard through that. It is not identical to the heartbeat, and that's their objection. They're saying, well, it's not a heartbeat because it's not the kind of heartbeat that we detect with a stethoscope. And that's true, but it is a heartbeat in so much that it is the very first manifestations of the cardiac activity, and it is the beginning of what will, during the development process, grow into what they're hearing. But it is actually the spasm or contraction of the cardiac tube that's working to move things through. It's just not identical to valves opening and closing into the chambers of the heart. So I think it feels disingenuous to me because, as I said, they're what it amounts to is them saying you can't call it a heartbeat, but you can call it heart activity. So, okay, it's heart activity. But and so it doesn't feel like the strong objection that they're making it out to be. Certainly not so they can mischaracterize the idea of we're saying we're hearing a heartbeat. Just because we say we're hearing a heartbeat, it doesn't mean by definition we're saying we're hearing the exact same kind of heartbeat. What we're saying is that we're hearing that rhythmic cardiac activity that is the beginning of the development of the heart as we will know it later on in a more mature human being.
Well, now I want to talk about one of the other big news stories regarding pro-life issues in the last month, and that is changes in the Republican Party's actual platform. One of the signature characteristics of the Republican Party, as it's been communicated particularly to Christians, is this is a party that is supporting things that line up with biblical orthodoxy. I don't know that they say that explicitly, but some of the different things that have in the past been part of the Republican Party platform. And one of those things has been abortion. Now, in the New York Times, there was an op-ed by a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is a conservative think tank. And that person was writing and saying that pro-lifers really helped bring various politicians, including the former president, to power. And they feel like in this new platform or altered language in the platform that some of this is very troubling to people who are pro-life Christians. So it seems like that there are big changes pertaining to this issue of abortion in the platform. Is it true? Exactly what were the changes in the platform and how are they different than they were in the past? Has there been a softening in the language regarding abortion?
Oh my gosh, yes. Now, I will say this, and this is, you mentioned this earlier, and it is something important as Christians to remember. I don't think any person with a healthy relationship with Christ believes that the goals of the church, of the church eternal, of God's church align perfectly with any political party. So if you think that the Republicans were ever the Christian party, you really probably weren't clearly thinking through the combination of what your theological understanding of what you are as a human being, your relationship to God, and your relationship to the government. But what they have been for 40 years is an alternative party for one whose platform, when you talk about the Democratic Party, is explicitly pro-abortion. Saying that we believe that it is important part of Democratic policy making to pursue abortion advocacy. So that one side is for abortion. And if you, and for the Republican Party has been a place where they said, look, you may not perfectly align with us, but on something as morally important as the issue of abortion, where something like a million lives are destroyed every year in the United States through the act of abortion, you have a party that you can empower or put hopefully into office that will frustrate the designs or intentions of a party who has full-throated advocacy for the idea that abortion is a good. And so that they got a lot. Now, when you ask, was there a change? Let me just, without being able to go over everything, for the 2020 Republican platform policy, there was something like 500 or so words that had to do with the value of human life. And included in that was the beginning of the discussion where it says, this is quoting the 2020 election platform, which was identical to the 2016. So this is President Donald Trump's Republican platform. The Constitution's guarantee that no one can be deprived of life, liberty, or property deliberately echoes the Declaration of Independence proclamation that all are endowed by their creator with the inalienable right to life. Accordingly, we assert the sanctity of human life and affirm that the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed. We support a human life amendment to the Constitution and legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to children before birth. Now, this goes on again for 500 words talking about a wide array of issues that you brought up early on when we talk about euthanasia, we talk about other issues, and they touch on all of this. In the 2024 platform, for the same nominee, Donald Trump as nominee for president, we have switched to something like 90 words. And here is, we proudly stand for families and life. We believe that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States guarantees that no person can be denied life or liberty without due process, and that states are therefore free to pass laws protecting those rights. So, that's radically different, right? There is no affirmation of a sanctity of human life for all. There is no support for a constitutional amendment. There's no support for a human life bill. There's no support for federal efforts. What they're saying now is, we think the 14th Amendment covers everybody, and so states can legislate how they want on this issue. Now, is that still better than the Democratic Party platform? Absolutely. The Democratic Party, but there are actually elements now that are overlap. If you take the Democratic National platform on this issue, when they talk about the issues of life, and you take the Republican Party, there's overlap on IVF and birth control. And they say fairly similar things. Now, you took something that was remarkably different from the Democratic platform. You pulled back support for this idea of a strong statement about the value of every single human life, no matter what age they are. And then you replaced it with language that's very similar to what the Democratic Party has on a couple of issues. You went from 500 words affirming the right to life and the importance of pursuing it in policy to 90 words that just says, yeah, the states can have this and we support IVF and we support birth control. Not even touching on the right or wrong of those issues. This isn't a discussion of the morality of that. This is just saying that you went from one kind of statement to another. So the sense of the Republican Party has backed away from the issue of abortion isn't just something that's felt by the pro-life side or the anti-abortion advocate. It's a reality. Their language is saying, we're out. We're just not, this is just not something, look, we believe it's okay. It's a state issue. We did our job with Dobbs versus Jackson. Now we're out. So yeah, it's changed.
So that is very interesting indeed. I think some Christians have concern about that. And what has been the response from this particular change in the platform from the Republicans already elected and in Congress who say that they are pro-life?
So look at Senator Marco Rubio, who has been, and I think will continue to be, I don't want to bash him personally, who has been a staunch supporter of the pro-life movement during his entire political career, outspoken, and speaks well on this, actually speaks very well as far as being able to articulate his position and to make arguments in the face of detractors who wish to try to nail him on this issue. Now, there was at this time he was hopeful to be at the same time the Republican vice president nominee, but he did say at this point, and his response to this was, look, there's a reality to the world that we live in right now. And the reality of the world that we live in is that abortion is not popular. And so the Republican platform is operating now within the restrictions of that reality, right? This is a realist platform because we want to be able to get things done. We want to be able to win a national election, which means we just have to right now gauge the comfort level of the community and back off of this issue. And so that's troubling, I guess, for the pro-life advocate, because that's one of your guys and he's not stepping up and saying, no, this is wrong. We shouldn't back off of this issue. He's saying, look, we have to be pragmatic at this point. So we're going to have to back off this issue a little bit right now, but we're going to win election, hopefully, and we'll be able to maintain power so that we can still continue to do the good that we want to do. We just can't make it the reason that we get elected any longer. And by the way, in addition to that, former President Trump said similar things where he warned Republican candidates, talk correctly on this. And what he means by talk correctly on abortion is leave it in the back burner for now. We're not going to win on this issue. Keep it back there. So it's a state's issue for him now.
Now, you mentioned Marco Rubio saying that, hey, look, we got to look at this pragmatically. So a question I have for you, is this a pragmatic move to change the platform rather dramatically than it has been in the past? Or is it a signal of a deeper philosophical shift? In other words, basically the Republican Party is also moving to become, you know, somebody who supports abortion because they just kind of see pragmatically that is something that is, you know, happening. And so we really don't want to focus on it like it's been focused on in the past. As a matter of fact, in the Roman Catholic Ethics magazine, First Things, they had an essay actually stating, is the Republican Party becoming pro-choice? And so is it something deeper and philosophical and they are becoming pro-choice? Or is it really just kind of for this election more of a pragmatic move?
You would like, for those who are hopeful, who have spent a lifetime working with the Republican Party, they'll point out two things. Number one, it doesn't really matter what the platform says. The important thing is that we still have a body of congressional representatives that are personally and passionately pro-life people, and that they're not going to abandon that just because the platform is different. The troubling aspects of that, and both R.R. Reno at First Things, in an article, The Republican Party Sidelines the Pro-Life Cause, he's the editor at First Things, and Jonathan Van Meren, who wrote the article at First Things that you mentioned, questioning or not whether or not the Republican Party is becoming pro-choice. Both of them mentioned the troubling aspects of this, because you'd like to think he's just being pragmatic when you think about candidate Trump trying to take office. And the problem is that, like, during the process of ratifying this new platform, they purposely have seen, Jonathan Van Meren quotes in his article, people who were there who felt marginalized, who they were intentionally put aside by the Republican. They weren't allowed to speak. They weren't allowed to offer amendments. They weren't allowed to debate or talk about it. They were surrounded by people. They took their cell phones so they couldn't share what was going on. And in one, I think he's the one that reports, they actually followed a woman to the women's bathroom because they were afraid she was going to go in there and share what was going on during this process. That doesn't feel friendly at all. Right. I mean, that's a troubling sign. The other thing is that as President Trump and then as a candidate since then, as somebody who wants to get back into office, but since then, particularly since the fall of Roe, Mr. Trump has reserved his harshest criticisms, not for supporters of abortion rights, but for people who have passed abortion restrictive laws. He was critical of Brian Kemp. He was critical of Ron DeSantis. He has outspokenly said about these people, oh, these are bad laws. We shouldn't be doing these. Heartbeat laws are bad things. And so his criticism seems to fall on those governors who are successfully passing abortion restriction in their states, where he says that these are not necessarily good things or these are outright bad things or bad laws, or he doesn't support those. So even as much as we would like to feel like, okay, this is just pragmatism, this is just a party that recognizes that it needs to lay low on abortion to be able to maintain its power on a national level, and as much as we'd like to be restful in the idea that there are still a lot of committed and principled pro-life people in the Republican Party who are currently serving in office, there are troubling signs when it looks like this is more than just pragmatism. This looks like people who, I didn't really want to be on this issue anyway. It's now a state's issue. It's out of the federal level. It's out of the national level. Let's leave it there and let's move on as a party to other things. So there are signs that I think that we should be worried. Yes.
I guess for some listeners, I want to bring it back before I ask you some wider questions about some of the things that have happened in terms of federal issues and states issues and things like that. I think there's some listeners that are saying, okay, I can't get into the weeds of all of these things, but really, honestly, help me understand, especially young people. That's what I'd say. Help me understand how the pregnancy of some woman I don't know in a different state is any of my business, is any of the government's business. It, again, back to that, you know, kind of apologetic from people who are for abortion that would say, this is a personal decision between a woman and her medical provider. And the reason why I ask this is some of our listeners who follow kind of cultural trends might know that recently there have been some studies out that show, this is kind of interesting, among Gen Z, so young people in their late teens through like their 20s, that more increasingly women are leaving Christianity if they had been religious at all, or are increasingly politically very progressive and very anti-spirituality, anti-religion, anti-Christian, as opposed to young men. So these are issues very much that are riling up the young Gen Z women because they are increasingly anti-religion. And there are some other religions that aren't Christian that, you know, would hold to some of these things about upholding unborn life. So how do you answer that young girl in her 20s? Because she said, okay, I hear you saying all this stuff. I don't really know if I care about the changes in the Republican Party, and maybe it's good time they changed it. It's been the same way for, you know, 40 years or what have you. So what would you say to her? She says, you know, hey, it's really none of my business or your business or the government's business what the pregnancy of some stranger in another state has to do with government at all.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say I was interviewing last year philosophy professor Christopher Tolleson from the University of South Carolina, and he's written two books, I think, of interest. One's called Embryo, and the other one is about medical practice. And in both of those, what he's talking about is how the way that we view life impacts the way that we both treat embryos, not just in the sake of how we treat them through the issue of abortion, but through research and other areas, and how the way that we understand what we are as human beings affects the medical field and the medical practice altogether. And when he and I were talking, one of the things that we discussed, and I've talked about this with a lot of other philosopher professors as well when I've had a chance to interview them, is that you have a sense that this doesn't matter to you, because I don't think that we fully understand the impact that the Christian worldview has had on society, the way that it has tamed us. And I mean that in the best sense of that word. I was talking to a young woman just yesterday after I spoke somewhere, and she and I were discussing what we don't understand oftentimes when we talk about sin, and when we talk about sin, we think of them as personal things, but we don't understand the depth or level of depravity that human beings are capable of going, unless you're researching particular events in human history where you get to see how awful people can be. And at the same time, or if you see particular areas of the world that weren't touched by Christianity and this view that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect, the idea that love your neighbor as yourself, and that this expansive idea of what our neighborhood means, even those people who hate us or persecute us, and this idea of taking care of the least of these, and those people who cannot contribute to society, they build in us an obligation or duty to look after them because we are strong and that we can. There are so many things that the Christian worldview brings to the table that is good for everyone, not just good for the Christian, not just good for the Republicans, not just good. It's good for those people who disagree. That's good for Democrats. It's good for people who support abortion. If they could fully understand how vitally important it is to see every human being as the image bearer of God and to recognize we have a duty or responsibility to not just treat them well, but to attend to their flourishing throughout our society, including in our government, if we lose that, you soon to find out what sin really is, because human beings detached from this, separated from this, get ugly really, really fast. There have been books written by non-Christians, particularly Tom Holland, the book Dominion, and other Christians. I have like four or five of them on my shelf in there that talk about the good that has been wrought in the world by the belief in Christ and what it means. There's a reason why biologist Dawkins identified himself as a cultural Christian. There's a reason for all of this, right? It's because the Christian story and what it means to love your neighbor is so powerful in its effect on the world. You need it. And so when you say, well, why should I care about this? Because it's just one more place that we have to look at how we're treating other human beings. And we have to ask ourselves questions every single time we try to give ourselves the license to destroy another human life, to take from that human life, to persecute that human life. Every single time there's another human being standing in front of us, we have to ask questions about what we think they are, about who we think they are, and what we think our obligations and duties are to them. And a life in a world where we respect other human beings and treat them as our neighbors and love them as we love ourselves, it's better for everyone. And so it just happens that politics are the practical way that we work out our beliefs in society. And we have to do this. It's not something that is, our beliefs are not apolitical. In order for us to be good citizens, we have to take what's important to us and figure out how we can work them out in society. Now, I will say this. I think that the pro-life position is unpopular in the world right now, and I don't think it's being received very well. That means what do we do next? We just keep speaking that question. What is the unborn? What are our duties and obligations to them? If they're human, why are they the kind of humans that we're allowed to kill? They are certainly human. We know that biologically. What makes human beings valuable? It's our shared humanity. It grounds our value. Why is it there? Because it's the only thing that we all share equally. And if there's such a thing as equal human dignity that transcends cultures and crosses borders and goes into every country, then it has to be grounded in something that every single one of us shares. And there is only one thing that we all share. It's our shared humanity. And then by extension from that, how can we ground such things as values, moral duties, and obligations? We ground them in the person of Jesus Christ. So all of this is vitally important to how we relate to one another. And we can't just set those questions aside, because as much as I would like to live a life that's entertaining just to me and to not worry about my neighbor and the people around me, I'm commanded by Christ to love my neighbor as myself, which means I have to get past myself and I have to get past my own particular pleasures and my own pursuit of success. And I have to care deeply as I care about myself, about what's going on in the lives of the people around me. And that's hard. And I do think, by the way, it's beautiful. And that's one of the things that I try to tell audiences. Look, it's beautiful when we care about each other and we fight for each other, and we ought to do it better than we do it. And I don't argue that there was some place in the past that we did this right and that we're going to get back there. I'm not somebody who's sentimental about the past. I see all the mistakes that we made and all the errors that we had back there. What I argue is that there's still an idea out there of loving my neighbor as myself, and there's a way to do it the way Christ would have me do it. And that's what I'm in pursuit of, not the past, not tradition, but the ideal of how God would have me treat my neighbor. And I am convinced to my core, and Christopher Tollefson and I both agreed about this when we talked about it, that a world that sees our neighbor as something valuable to us, and a world that drives us to love our neighbors ourselves, where all human beings are treated with equal dignity and respect, That's a world that will help us to navigate all of the challenges that biotechnology as it advances are bringing to our doorstep. This only gets more complicated from here. It doesn't get easier. And it will be better for all if we start that from the place that we love our neighbor and not that we wish that they weren't there or that they're a problem that we don't need to worry about or that I have other things on my plate right now. Those are very self-centered views. And we're at our best when we're looking beyond ourselves.
I do think those are big questions. We have to answer the question if an embryo and a fetus is exactly human, and why is human life worth preserving? As much as people would say that other human lives, once they're born, and we're not just saying the unborn aren't worthy, only the unborn, right? But you would want to take people who are saying it's not the unborn, but it's the other. So those are really good food for thought for people. And I guess the question for me is really that I'd like to ask you is, it seems that there's been a lot of ink spilled in the media that the pro-life movement's kind of at a crossroads now that Roe has been overturned. And so what are the, challenges? And they seem substantial that the pro-life position is facing in the public square as it's going forward. So where does it go from here? Because there is such I think people have their deep convictions in one, if you're a pro-life person or if you're a pro-abortion person, everyone's really entrenched in their positions right now, it seems like. And so where does the pro-life movement go? Because it seems that it's been a shift just since the overturn of Roe v. Wade. And so how do they face those challenges and really have their position being talked about in the public square?
I think first we have to embrace the idea that, it doesn't matter if the Republican Party is on our side. It doesn't change our job. Our job has always been the same. We have to advocate for all life, including the unborn. And for the pro-life position, that's what we do. I mean, that's the definition. If we're fighting over this issue, arguing over this issue of abortion, but we're not doing it because we want to win. We're doing it because we want to win lives. And so it's not a battle that we want to win rhetorically. We use rhetoric to save lives. It's not a battle that we want to win legally. We want to use the law to save and preserve life. The goal is to cherish life. And it's not just the unborn, as you said, after they're born and all the way through. The same people that feel that way also want to work in those other areas. But as it pertains to the issue of abortion, we have to stay locked in on what it is that we're talking about. It didn't become suddenly okay to kill the unborn if the pro-life position becomes unpopular. Nor are we allowed to sit back and say nothing just because some people don't like us talking or people become louder and their distaste for how we pursue this. Look, I think that we have one way forward, and that's to get back to the basics, right? We have to make our case. I think Daniel Darling made an interesting point in an article that he wrote where he said, we can take for granted that we've already educated the past generation. For example, and I that resonated with me because I spent 10 years on the road speaking to high schoolers, right? I would go to high schools and I would speak about this issue and talk about the value of human life. 10 years of my life spent on the road, visiting high schools all across the country and making a case. I could feel like I've made my case to high schoolers. The problem is there's a whole new crop of high schoolers and that's a whole new generation that's out there right now. And they haven't heard our case. COVID hurt the ability to get into high schools. And then after that, it's been more difficult for people to get into high schools and people don't care about it the same way because Roe v. Wade is gone. And what Daniel Darling's point was, I think is very well taken. We can believe that we've already spoken this generation, but the generation we spoke to has grown up and has all got jobs. And now there's a new generation that we have to educate, that we have to take the responsibility to pass on what's most important as far as what it means to be human, our obligations and duties to one another. So I think that refocusing ourselves back on education, on being able to make a case by going to people and making our case and say, not that we're oppressive white men who are looking to force women to do what we want and want to force birth and force pregnancy and to control women's bodies because we hate sex and all of those other things that people like to say about us, but that all of those people, men and women and children, all of the people of all races that are working in the pro-life community are doing it for one reason. because we believe from the moment they come into existence, they're valuable members of the human family, and there's things that we ought not to do to them. And that once we give ourselves license to do that to them, we will give ourselves license to do it to other human families, other human beings, all throughout our human family. We have a responsibility and duty to take care of the least of these, and they are one of us. They are our neighbor. And we are commanded by Christ to love our neighbors, ourselves, and our neighborhood expands and it includes them. This isn't about oppression. This isn't about winning politics. This is about saving the lives of our fellow human beings and allowing them to live, not just because we want to treat them as we ought to treat them, but because once we play the game of telling them that they're not allowed to live, that game becomes even more expansive and we start to tell other people and other groups that we can restrict them, take their life, and we all are at risk. Abraham Lincoln made this case when he was talking about slavery in his debates with Stephen Douglas, where he said, "Give me any reason that you say that it's okay to enslave another man, to enslave the black man specifically, and I will demonstrate for you that the very reason that you give can be turned around and used against you. Someone can enslave you by the same justification. It's safer and it's better for all people if we just get rid of slavery so that none of us can be enslaved. It's safer and better for all human beings if we just cherish all human life so that none of our lives can be taken against our will because we're deemed inconvenient later on down the road." So we have to make our case. We have to let's just start over. Let's just go out there and make our case. Make our case to whatever audience we can get. And it may be your neighbor. It may be a high school. It may be anybody and everybody. We need to write it. We need to speak it because we have to recognize. And Robert George at Princeton University points us out all the time. Every institution is against us. Music industry is abortion advocacy. The television industry is abortion advocacy. The video game industry is abortion. They are all on the other side and they are controlling the flow of information to the next generation and they are winning. So we have to make our case personally. We have to build up a group of people who can make a case graciously and go to their neighbor and say, "Look, I know what you're hearing. I know what you're feeling. I know what you're sensing, but we got to protect human life from the moment it comes into existence. The unborn are one of us. The fetal human is one of us. The embryonic human is one of us. We have to love them as we love ourselves, and we have to restrict what we're allowed to do to them." That's the only place I can think of to go from here. We may be unpopular, but our message never changes. And you know, we can't worry about what people think about us. It'll swing back. If there's one thing that we know is that swing towards the other side will be bound. The other side will get more excited about what they feel like they can say, and they'll start saying things that become troubling and bothersome to people, and they'll hear themselves saying things that they don't like. When they start talking about this full-throated advocacy for abortion all the way through 9 months, and I hear people saying, I read just this morning where somebody in response to criticism about late-term abortion, and this we were talking about 26 weeks and on, these are very late-term abortions, they were arguing for the position that women should still be allowed to do whatever they want for whatever reason they want. And that kind of argument may land well with the supporters, but it won't land well with the people that you're hoping to convince. And that's what will facilitate the swing back. And then the whole landscape will change again. And we'll have to figure out how to deal with it when people are more agreeable to our view and they'll figure out what they're going to do. We just have to keep going, keep moving forward, keep making our case.
And I think I want to end with just reminding our listeners that the point of this is not anything political, but it has to do with Christian orthodoxy. And once you're a Christian, you have to learn what it means to have a Christian worldview and think Christianly about every single topic as God talks about in the Bible. And so it is very important as Christians that we are brave and we have courage and we stand up for what is true, because we believe that Christianity is true. So
told the great commandments. But I mean, in brief, the great commandments are love the Lord your God with everything that you have and love your neighbor as yourself. And that's a daunting task, right? Because I have to figure out then who is my neighbor. And then I have to figure out what it means to love them as I love myself. And that's the first thing I have to do in my relationship with others. So no, I agree with you. This has nothing to do with politics. Politics are just how we work out our beliefs in the public square. The first place we have to deal with is who, what, and what we are. And that's daunting. That's a daunting task to love my neighbor as myself.
Well, now on a much lighter note, I don't know if everyone knows or if even Jay knows that upcoming in August, on August 3rd is National Georgia Day. And it's the day set aside to celebrate the state of Georgia as the fourth state to join the union. And That is where Jay lives. So, Jay, what is your elevator pitch about why Georgia is so great?
Well, first of all, the topography of Georgia is remarkable. You have the mountains in the north, you have the plains in the middle, you have swampland, you have beautiful coastland. Everything you could look for is in the state of Georgia, and life grows in Georgia. We are so green. It's such a green state. I love how I miss it when I go to other parts of the country and it's just overwhelming. The great thing about Georgia is if you turn your back on your yard for a second, it just overwhelms you. You have to fight back. That's how much things grow and how fruitful the state of Georgia is. So it's beautiful. And I will say, on the other side, as far as the people goes, people differ all over the country and we all have different personalities and different things that we think are normal. You know, a lot of movies are filmed here. Walking Dead was one of the first television shows that was a really big, huge hit that was filmed here. And I remember reading the cast of Walking Dead and they were joking about how they all came from not just different parts of the country, but from different countries, right? A lot of them are British. And they were talking about growing accustomed to Georgia. And what they meant by that was if they went to get breakfast in the morning or get coffee in the morning and they walked into a place, you say, "Hey, how's it going?" And you have a conversation with them. And they said it was odd to them at first because these are strangers and they didn't come from a part of the country where that was normal. But after living here for a year, they loved that rhythm of the expectation of there's somebody in front of you, you need to recognize them. And I had to warn my kids, another part. We were in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago and I had to tell my daughters we're walking around New Jersey and she keeps telling "Hey" to everybody. I'm like, they don't do that here. They think you're weird for doing that here, right? Every person that made eye contact with her, she says hi and smiles at them because that's the way we are down here. That's a very Southern sensibility. So for one, it's just beautiful land and it's a beautiful state. And the other thing is just the rhythms of life are really friendly. A lot of the things that you hear about Georgia, as far as some of the negative stereotypes from the rest of the country, are often driven by people who have an agenda or hatred or whatever. I mean, if you go to downtown Atlanta, and you go to over Stone Mountain, you see neighborhoods and entire communities are built by wealthy and prosperous Black people who have found a home and ability to make a life for themselves where they can be anything and everything that they want to be. And culturally, that group runs Atlanta in this sense of defining the personality of Atlanta. Where I live in a neighborhood that's got a very nice school in this area, I am surrounded by people from all over. It's a very international community. You go to the public parks, there are people from all over the world, all different parts of Asia. People have moved here and have set up life here. So it's my church is actually growing more and more diverse all the time because our community has completely changed. So the people in Georgia, the rhythms of Georgia are very Southern, very friendly. You stop and talk to people. The land is beautiful. That you can go anywhere. I can go to the mountains. I can go to the plains. I can go to the beach. I can go to swamps. I can go anywhere and see everything in the state of Georgia. And in addition to that, both Buc-ee's and Whataburger have moved here recently. So if you're coming from some other part of the country, you can still get some of your taste of home here as well. So it's both a fascinatingly international place because the city of Atlanta has drawn people from all over the world, and that just continues to grow and grow, and they invest their new cultural, new restaurants, new tastes, different things that you can experience, and there's still some of that old Southern charm all over the place as well. I just love my home. I love my home.
Well, thanks for the pitch to visit Georgia, and thanks for being on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 404 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jay Watts, and he has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "A String of Losses for the Pro-Life Movement and Our Message of Hope." And you can read it for free at equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal, Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.